Okay, so I have seen a lot of aggressive financial advice in our deep dives. We've done crypto, we've done real estate flipping, drop shipping,
All of it.
but I have never, and I mean never seen, a document that explicitly outlines a strategy called How to Legally Rob Banks in 2025.
It's a title that doesn't exactly leave much room for interpretation, does it?
It barely leaves room for the law, but that's the hook. Today we're unpacking a stack of sources that, I mean, it feels like a head-on collision between two completely different
It
universes.
really does.
On one side, you have this incredibly high-risk, high-reward roadmap. It's all about generating hundreds of thousands of dollars in business credit. We're talking credit stacking, manipulating browser tabs, LLCs, like Lego bricks.
And then, sitting right there next to the instructions on legal bank robbery, you have a guide to personal mastery.
Exactly.
Stoic philosophy, breathing exercises, reminders that obsession is ugly.
It is so bizarre. It's like reading a manual co-written by a hedge fund shark and a Buddhist monk. We've got stuff from creators like My Life or Debt, Tyrell Brown, all mixed in with this productivity and life success quick reference guide.
Yeah.
So the mission today is to figure out if these two sides can actually coexist. I mean, can you be a ruthless capitalist in the streets and a detached philosopher in the sheets?
That is the ultimate question here. And I think what we're looking at is a blueprint for a very specific type of, modern character. The material suggests that to win in 2025, you have to hack the financial system, but you also have to hack your own brain just to survive the stress of it all.
Well, let's start with the system hacking because the claims here are just, they're absolutely wild. I mentioned the headline, but let's get into the mechanics. One of the first things that jumped out at me was this claim about credit repair.
Oh, yeah.
Source one literally says you can fix your credit in 7 days using consumer law. 7 days. That sounds, let's just say, optimistic.
Optimistic is putting it very, very politely.
Oh, yeah.
It borders on legal fiction. So when these guides talk about consumer law, they usually mean the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the FCRA, and the standard process to dispute something on your credit, say a late payment, that takes 30 to 45 days. The bureaus legally have that window.
So how are they getting to 7 days? What's the trick?
They're pushing for what's basically an aggressive mass dispute strategy. The idea is you just flood the bureaus with affidavits, claiming errors, non-compliance, hoping to overwhelm the system.
So you're not really fixing it, you're just jamming the gear.
Exactly. You're hoping they just delete the negative items to clear the queue.
Yeah.
It's high risk,
Yeah.
and honestly, it often backfires if they flag you for frivolous disputes.
Okay, so step one is essentially bullying the credit bureaus. Let's assume you pull it off, though. Your score is up. The blueprint then shifts to this unbelievably complex entity structure. I felt like I needed a law degree just to follow this. It's create three LLCs, they hold two trusts, then assign ownership to a business LLC. Why on earth do you need all those layers for a credit card?
This is where we get into what they call the corporate veil. In this world of high-limit funding, the goal, as Tyrell Brown lays it out, is no PG.
Okay, no PG. Define that for us.
No personal guarantee. So normally, if you open a small business credit card, you, the owner, you're personally on the hook.
Right, you sign the dotted line.
And if the business goes bust, the bank comes for your house, your car, everything. This whole structure is an attempt to engineer an entity that looks so robust and independent on paper that banks will lend to the company without making you sign your life away.
So you're insulating yourself completely.
Exactly. It's all about asset protection.
Yeah.
If the business fails, the debt dies with the LLC, not with you.
And the numbers they're talking about, they're not small. This isn't for a $5,000 Staples card. The sources are explicitly aiming for what, 20K, 30K, 50K per
Our
application.
application.
And to get there, they describe the specific technical thing, the one browser trick. Did you catch this part?
I did. This
Huh.
is classic loophole mentality.
Walk us through it. It sounds like something a teenager would invent to hack a video game.
It kind of does, doesn't it? So the premise is when you apply for credit, the bank does a hard pull on your report. That inquiry gets a timestamp. If you apply for five cards in a week, the later banks see the earlier inquiries.
And they get nervous. You look desperate.
Exactly. You look risky. The one browser trick is where you open multiple tabs for different bank applications in one window. You fill them all out right to the very last step, and then you hit submit on all of them at almost the exact same time.
So it's a race condition. You're trying to beat the system.
Precisely. You're trying to beat the propagation delay. The theory is that if all the inquiries hit the bureau servers simultaneously, Bank A doesn't know you just applied to Bank B, C, and D. You're trying to sneak five people through a revolving door before it starts spinning.
Okay, that is devious. So let's play this out. You've bullied the bureaus, you've built your weird trust fortress, you've tab-blasted the banks, and now you have, say, $150,000 in credit. What does the blueprint say to do with it? Because if the answer is buy a Lamborghini, I'm done.
Thankfully, no Lamborghinis. The advice here is actually surprisingly, well, boring. And I mean that as a compliment.
Boring isn't good.
In business, yes. They don't suggest crypto or volatile stocks. They suggest boring businesses that are asset heavy. One of the main ideas from My Life or Debt is buying land for glamping tents.
Glamping tents? So we're legally robbing banks to set up luxury camping.
Well, think about the cash flow. The source mentions a $5,000 down payment to control the land. Then you use that high-limit business credit, which often has 0% interest for the first year, to buy the tents, the decks, the furniture.
You could just swipe a card for all of that.
You can. Then you put it on Airbnb, and you generate cash flow to pay down that debt before the interest kicks in.
It's an arbitrage play. You're using 0% interest money to build a cash-flowing asset.
Exactly. And they list other businesses, too. Laundromats, parking lots, storage facilities. You see the pattern.
Yeah, you can buy the inventory with a credit card.
Right. You can buy washing machines with a Visa. You can't really buy a consulting business that way.
And if you don't want to start from scratch, they give you a shopping list of websites. Foreclosure.com, auction.com, omizoom.com. It's a very specific vibe. Find distressed assets and buy them with other people's money.
The classic OPM strategy just accelerated. But I want to point out a crucial contrast here. Amidst all this hacking and stacking, there's a guide from Shafat Caesar on how to start a business. And it is shockingly normal.
It felt like the adult in the room, didn't it?
It really did. Caesar isn't talking about trusts and browser tricks. He's talking about checking if your business name is available, getting an EIN, setting up Stripe or QuickBooks.
The boring stuff.
The boring but necessary stuff. It's a reality check. The cheat codes might get you the funding, but they don't run the laundromat for you. You still need a payment processor. You still have to pay taxes.
That's the perfect segue. Because once you have the money and the glamping site, you have to manage the chaos. And this is where the material just shifts gears completely. We go from consumer law hacks to what I'm calling the operating system for your life.
This is the Productivity and Life Success Quick Reference Guide.
And it is so heavy on artificial intelligence. It's like the authors know that managing three LLCs and a glamping business is impossible for one person, so they're outsourcing their executive function to AI.
It's smart, actually. The guide doesn't just say use AI. It treats AI like a chief of staff. There's a specific prompt that says, help me create the ultimate daily schedule. Consider my waking hours from start to end.
Yeah, it asks the AI to prioritize tasks based on your energy levels. It's about auditing your own time.
Right.
I like this section on mastering deep work. The prompt literally asks the AI to design a workspace and a routine just to minimize distractions. It's acknowledging that if you're doing this hustle, your focus is your most expensive resource.
And that ties directly into the laws of discipline section. This is where we start seeing that bridge between the money and the philosophy. You have these laws like delay gratification and embrace hard work.
Do it when you don't feel like it.
Right. The financial section is selling a shortcut, get money fast. But the productivity section is admitting a hard truth. Keeping that money requires grinding. It explicitly says, control your emotions. Don't let anger or laziness dictate actions.
Which is easier said than done, especially when the very next section suggests you should be treating every single human interaction like a chess match. We have to talk about the psychology tricks.
Ah, yes, the dark arts section.
It really is. It's called 25 psychology tricks that always work, and some of these feel borderline sociopathic. One of them is just silence.
It's a classic negotiation tactic.
Yeah.
You ask a question, the other person gives a half answer, and you just wait.
Right.
You stay silent. Maintain eye contact. Say nothing.
It makes people so uncomfortable.
It does. Most people hate silence, so they rush to fill it, and they often reveal more than they meant to. It's weaponized awkwardness.
And then there's the Benjamin Franklin effect. This one always messes with my head. Explain how this works because it seems totally backward.
Okay, so common sense would say, if I want you to like me, I should do a favor for you. But the Benjamin Franklin effect says I should ask you to do a small favor for me.
Why does that work?
Cognitive dissonance. If you do something nice for me, your brain has to justify it. Your brain goes, well, I must like this person. Otherwise, why would I be lending them my pen? It tricks the other person into liking you by getting them to invest in you.
That is just so devious. It's treating social connection as just another algorithm you can hack.
It fits the theme, doesn't it? Hack the bank, hack your schedule, hack the person across the table.
But then we hit part four. And this is where the whiplash happens. We go from manipulate everyone to a section called 12 Laws of Philosophy. And the tone isn't aggressive anymore. It's kind of, well, it's kind of sad.
Sober is the word I would use. It's incredibly stark.
One of the laws is just, everyone leaves. Learn to survive alone.
Find solace in solitude.
And my personal favorite contrast, the entire financial section requires you to be absolutely obsessed with paperwork and details to get that money. But the philosophy section says, quote, obsession is ugly. Do your best to avoid it. How do you even reconcile that?
You know, that's the core contradiction of this whole blueprint. On one hand, success requires obsession. You can't start three LLCs and a glamping business casually. It takes over your life.
Right.
But the philosophy section, it acts as a warning mechanism. It's almost saying, look, if you go down this path, you're going to be lonely and you're going to need to detach from the outcome just to survive it.
The less you care, the happier you'll be. That's in the text.
It is. It's basically stoicism as a survival strategy.
Mm-hmm.
If you're leveraging $200,000 in debt, you better learn how not to take things personally or the cortisol will kill you.
There's also some weirdly specific life advice mixed in. It's not all high-level philosophy. It's also, it is worth investing in good betting.
Practical stoicism. If you're going to be up all night worried about your leverage ratio, you might as well be comfortable.
And blocking exes is a really good idea.
Which totally aligns with the protect your energy theme. If it drains you, it's not for you. Whether that's a bad debt or a bad relationship, the guide is ruthless about cutting dead weight.
There's also a really interesting point about self-image. You look how you look, accept it. Which, again, feels so different from the fake it till you make it vibe of the credit section.
I think what we're seeing here is the difference between the outer game and the inner game. The outer game, the business, the credit, the negotiation, that's all manipulation and appearance. It's about looking bigger than you are to the banks.
Mm-hmm.
But the inner game, the philosophy, is telling you that to sustain that charade, you have to be radically honest with yourself. You have to accept your looks, your solitude, and accept that recognition doesn't matter.
Forget credit and recognition. That's literally one of the principles, which is so ironic because the whole first part of the document is about getting credit.
Financial credit, yes. But social credit. Validation. The source says to let it go. It introduces this idea of alive time versus dead time.
Break that down. What does that mean in this context?
It's a concept from Robert Greene. Dead time is when you're passive, just waiting for things to happen, you know, complaining that the bank hasn't approved you yet. Alive time is when you are active, learning, using every second. The blueprint is saying, even if you're broke, even if you're waiting for an LLC approval, use that time, learn, plan, don't just sit there.
It all culminates in this archetype of a person when you step back and look at the learner this whole stack is trying to build. Who is this person?
It's a fascinating, if maybe slightly terrifying figure. We could call them the modern warlord. This person is financially aggressive, exploiting every legal loophole for capital. They're hyper-productive with AI. They're socially calculated, but internally. They're trying to be a monk.
Right.
They're telling themselves nothing matters and don't be obsessed just to keep from burning out.
It feels like a suit of armor. The money is the shield, the psychology is the sword, and the philosophy is the padding on the inside so you don't get bruised by your own metal.
That's a brilliant analogy. But it raises the question, is this freedom? The document is titled Financial Freedom and Personal Mastery. But does this look like freedom to you?
It looks like a ton of work. It looks like a high-stress video game where you're just constantly managing stats.
And that brings us to one of the most provocative lines in the whole thing from the 32 lessons section. It says, not many can turn their passion into a career. Good luck. The cost is huge.
That line stuck with me, too. The cost is huge. We're always told to do what you love.
Exactly. But this source is cynical about passion. It implies that turning what you love into work just ruins it. So the alternative presents is don't follow your passion, follow the money. Rob the banks legally, build the laundromat, get the glamping tents, buy your freedom from the need to monetize your passion.
So the strategy is be a ruthless capitalist so you can afford to be a philosopher.
Ideally. But the danger is getting stuck in the capitalist phase. You get the $250,000 in credit, and instead of finding peace, you just want $500,000. You forget the obsession is ugly rule because the obsession starts paying off.
So for our listener sitting there thinking, should I do this? Should I try the 7-day credit fix?
I think the takeaway is to treat this as a buffet, not a prefix menu. You don't have to eat everything. You can use the structure advice to protect your assets without doing the risky one browser trick. You can use the AI prompts to get organized without becoming a social manipulator.
You can invest in good betting without owning three LLCs.
You absolutely can. And honestly, that might be the highest ROI advice in the entire stack.
It really is. So we've unpacked the hustle, the hacks, and the inner peace. But I want to leave the listener with that one lingering thought.
The cost of passion.
Right. If the cost of following your passion is huge, you have to ask yourself, what is the cost of this blueprint? What is the cost of viewing every social interaction as a negotiation? What's the cost of viewing your life as just a series of credit inquiries?
Are you buying your freedom, or are you just financing a different kind of cage?
Something to think about while you're setting up those glamping tents. Thanks for diving in with us. We'll catch you on the next one.